Chapter 8. The word dénouement is not only the name of a hotel, or the family who manages it, particularly nowadays, when the hotel and all its secrets have almost been forgotten, and the surviving members of the family have changed their names and are working in smaller, less glamorous inns. Dénouement comes from the French, who use the word to describe the act of untying a knot, and it refers to the unravelling of a confusing or mysterious story, such as the lives of the Baudelaire orphans, or anyone else you know whose life is filled with unanswered questions. The dénouement is the moment when all of the knots of a story are untied, and all the threads are unravelled, and everything is laid out clearly for the world to see. But the dénouement should not be confused with the end of a story. The dénouement of Snow White, for instance, occurs at the moment when Ms. White wakes up from her enchanted sleep and decides to leave the dwarves behind and marry the handsome prince, and the mysterious old woman who gave her an apple has been exposed as the treacherous queen. But the end of Snow White occurs many years later, when a horseback riding accident plunges Miss White into a fever from which she never recovers. The dénouement of Goldilocks and the Three Bears occurs at the moment when the bears return home to find Goldilocks napping on their private property and either chase her away from the premises or eat her, depending on which version you have in your library. But the end of Goldilocks and the Three Bears occurs when a troop of young scouts neglect to extinguish their campfire, and even the efforts of a volunteer fire department cannot save most of the wildlife from certain death. There are some stories in which the dénouement and the end occur simultaneously, such as La Forza del Destino, in which the characters recognize and destroy one another over the course of a single song. But usually, the dénouement of a story is not the last event in the heroes' lives, or the last trouble that befalls them. It is often the second-to-last event, or the penultimate peril. As the Baudelaire orphans followed the mysterious man out of the hotel and through the cloud of steam to the edge of the reflective pond, the dénouement of their story was fast approaching. But the end of their story still waited for them, like a secret still covered in fog, or a distant island in the midst of a troubled sea, whose waves raged against the shores of a city and the walls of a perplexing hotel.
"You must have thousands of questions, Baudelaire's," said the man. "And just think, right here is where they can be answered."
"Who are you?" Violet asked.
"I'm Dewey dénouement,"
Dewey dénouement replied.
"The third triplet. Haven't you heard of me?"
"No,"
Klaus said. "We thought there were only Frank and Ernest." "Frank and Ernest get all the attention," Dewey said. "They get to walk around the hotel managing everything, while I just hide in the shadows and wind the clock."
He gave the Baudelaires an enormous sigh and scowled into the depths of the pond.
"That's what I don't like about VFD, he said. "All the smoke and mirrors."
"Smoke?"
Sonny asked.
"Smoke and mirrors," Klaus explained, "means trickery used to cover up the truth. But what does that have to do with VFD?
"Before the schism," Dewey said, "VFD was like a public library. Anyone could join us and have access to all of the information we'd acquired. Volunteers all over the globe were reading each other's research, learning of each other's observations, and borrowing each other's books. For a while it seemed as if we might keep the whole world safe, secure, and smart."
"It must have been a wonderful time," Klaus said.
"I scarcely remember it," Dewey said. "I was 4 years old when the schism began. I was scarcely tall enough to reach my favourite shelf in the family library, the books labelled 020. But one night, just as our parents were hanging balloons for our fifth birthday party, my brothers and I were taken."
"Taken where?" Violet asked.
"Taken by whom?" Sunny asked. I admire your curiosity, Dewey said. The woman who took me said that one can remain alive long past the usual date of disintegration if one is unafraid of change, insatiable in intellectual curiosity, interested in big things, and happy in small ways. And she took me to a place high in the mountains where she said such things would be encouraged.
Klaus opened his commonplace book and began to take furious notes. The headquarters, Klaus said, in the Valley of Four Drafts. Your parents must have missed you, Violet said.
They perished that very night, Dewey said, in a terrible fire. I don't have to tell you how badly I felt when I learnt the news.
The Baudelaire sighed and looked out at the pond. Here and there on its calm surface they could see the reflections of a few lights in the windows, but most of the hotel was dark, so most of the pond was dark, too. The triplet, of course, did not have to tell the Baudelaires how it felt to lose one's parents so suddenly or at such a young age.
It was not always this way, Baudelaires, Dewey said. Once there were safe places scattered across the globe, and so orphans like yourselves did not have to wander from place to place, trying to find noble people who could be of assistance. With each generation, the schism gets worse. If justice does not prevail, soon there will be no safe places left, and nobody left to remember how the world ought to be.
I don't understand, Violet said. Why weren't we taken, like you?
You were, Dewey said. You were taken into the custody of Count Olaf, and he tried to keep you in his custody, no matter how many noble people intervened.
But why didn't anyone tell us what was going on? Klaus asked. Why did we have to figure things out all by ourselves?
I'm afraid that's the wicked way of the world, Dewey said with a shake of his head. Everything's covered in smoke and mirrors, Baudelaires. Since the schism, all the research, all the observations, even all of the books have been scattered all over the globe. It's like the elephant in the poem your father loved. Everyone has their hands on a tiny piece of the truth, but nobody can see the whole thing. Very soon, however, all that will change.
Thursday,
Sunny said.
Exactly, Dewey said,
smiling down at the youngest Baudelaire.
At long last, all of the noble people will be gathered together, along with all the research they've done, all the observations they've made, all the evidence they've collected, and all the books they've read. Just as a library catalogue can tell you where a certain book is located, this catalogue can tell you the location and behaviour of every volunteer and every villain.
He gestured to the hotel.
For years, he said, while noble people wandered the world observing treachery, my comrade and I have been right here, gathering all the information together. We've copied every note from every commonplace book from every volunteer and compiled it all into a catalogue. Occasionally, when volunteers have been lost or safe places destroyed, we've had to go ourselves to collect the information that has been left behind. We've retrieved Josephine Anwistle's files from Lake Lacrimose and carefully copied down their contents. We've pasted together the burnt scraps of Madame Lulu's archival library and taken notes on what we've found. We've searched the childhood home of the man with a beard but no hair and interviewed the math teacher of the woman with hair but no beard. We've memorized important articles within the stacks of newspaper in Poultryville, and we've thrown important items out of the windows of our destroyed headquarters so they might wind up somewhere safe at sea. We've taken every crime, every theft, every wicked deed, and every incident of rudeness since the schism began, and catalogued them into an entire library of misfortune. Eventually, every crucial secret ends up in my catalogue. It's been my life's work. It has not been an easy life, but it has been an informative one.
You're more than a volunteer, Violet said. You're a librarian. I'm more of a sub-sub-librarian, Dewey said modestly. That's what your parents used to call me, because my library work has been largely undercover and underground. Every villain in the world would want to destroy all this evidence, so it's been necessary to hide my life's work away. But where could you hide something that enormous? Klaus said. It would be like hiding an elephant. A catalogue that immense would have to be as big as the hotel itself.
It is,
Dewey said, with a sly expression on his face. In fact, it's exactly as big as the hotel. Violet and Klaus turned their gaze from Dewey to look at each other in confusion. But Sunny was gazing neither at the sub-sub-librarian nor at her siblings, but down at the dark surface of the pond.
Aha!
She said, pointing a small, gloved finger at the calm, still water. Exactly, Dewey said. The truth has been right under everyone's noses, if anyone cared to look past the surface. Volunteers and villains alike know that the last safe place is the Hotel Denouement, but no one has ever questioned why the sign is written backward. They're staying in the Hotel Denouement, while the real last safe place, the catalogue, is hidden safely at the bottom of the pond in underwater rooms organized in a mirror image of the hotel itself. Our enemies could burn the entire building to the ground, but the most important secrets would be safe. But if the location of the catalogue is such an important secret, Violet said, why are you telling us? Because you should know, Dewey said. You've wandered the world, observing more villainy and gathering more evidence than most people do in a lifetime. I'm sure the observations and evidence you've gathered in your commonplace book will be valuable contributions to the catalogue. Who better than you to keep the world's most important secrets? He looked out at the pond, and then at each orphan in turn. After Thursday, he continued, you won't have to be at sea any more, Baudelaires. The children knew that by the expression at sea, he meant lost and confused, and hearing those words brought tears to their eyes. I hope you decide to make this your permanent home. I need someone with an inventive imagination who can improve on the aquatic design of the catalogue. I need someone with the sort of research skills that can expand the catalogue until it is the finest in the world. And of course we'll need to eat, and I've heard wonderful things about Sunny's cooking.
F. Caristo,
Sunny said modestly.
Hal's meals are atrocious, I'm afraid, Dewey said with a rueful smile. I don't know why he insisted on opening his restaurant in room 954 when so many other suitable rooms were available. Bad food of any style is unpleasant, but bad Indian food is possibly the worst.
Hal is a volunteer? Klaus asked, remembering what Sunny had observed during her errands as a concierge.
In a manner of speaking, Dewey said, using an expression which here means sort of.
After the fire that destroyed Heimlich Hospital, my comrade arrived on the scene to catalogue any information that might have survived. She found Hal in a very distraught condition. His library of records was in shambles, and he had nowhere to live. She offered him a position at the Hotel Denouement, where he might aid us in our research and learn to cook. Unfortunately, he's only been good at one of those things.
And what about Charles?
Violet asked, remembering what Klaus had observed during his errands.
Charles has been searching for you since he left the lumber mill, Dewey said. He cares for you, Baudelaires, despite the selfish and dreadful behaviour of his partner. You've seen your share of wicked people, Baudelaires, but you've seen your share of people as noble as you are.
I'm not sure we are noble, Klaus said quietly, flipping the pages of his commonplace book.
We caused those accidents at the lumber mill. We're responsible for the destruction of the hospital.
we helped start the fire that destroyed Madame Lulu's archival library. We...
Enough, Dewey interrupted gently, putting a hand on Klaus's shoulder.
You're noble enough, Baudelaire's. That's all we can ask for in this world.
The middle Baudelaire hung his head, so he was leaning against the sub-sub-librarian, and his sisters huddled against him, and all four volunteers stood for a moment silently in the dark. Tears fell from the eyes of the orphans, all four of them, and as with many tears shed at night, they could not have said exactly why they were crying, although I know why I am crying as I type this, and it is not because of the onions that someone is slicing in the next room, or because of the wretched curry he is planning on making with them. I am crying because Dewey Denouement was wrong. He was not wrong when he said the Baudelaires were noble enough, although I suppose many people might argue about such a thing if they were sitting around a room together without a deck of cards or something good to read. Dewey was wrong when he said that being noble enough is all we can ask for in this world, because we can ask for much more than that. We can ask for a second helping of pound cake, even though someone has made it quite clear that we will not get any. We can ask for a new watercolour set, even though it will be pointed out that we never used the old one, and that all of the paints dried into a crumbly mess. We can ask for Japanese fighting fish to keep us company in our bedroom, and we can ask for a special camera that will allow us to take photographs even in the dark, for obvious reasons, and we can ask for an extra sugar cube in our coffees in the morning, and an extra pillow in our beds at night. We can ask for justice, and we can ask for a handkerchief, and we can ask for cupcakes, and we can ask for all the soldiers in the world to lay down their weapons and join us in a rousing chorus of Cry Me a River, if that happens to be our favourite song. But we can also ask for something we are much more likely to get, and that is to find a person or two somewhere in our travels who will tell us that we are noble enough, whether it is true or not. We can ask for someone who will say, "You are noble enough," and remind us of our good qualities when we have forgotten them, or cast them into doubt. Most of us, of course, have parents and friends who tell us such things, after we have lost a badminton tournament, or failed to capture a notorious counterfeiter who we discovered aboard a certain motorboat. But the Baudelaire orphans, of course, had no living parents, and their closest friends were high in the sky in a self-sustaining hot air mobile home, battling eagles, and a terrible henchman who had hooks instead of hands. So the acquaintance of Dewey Denouement and the comforting words he had uttered were a blessing. The Baudelaire stood with the sub-sub-librarian, grateful for this blessing, and at the sound of an approaching automobile, they looked to see two more blessings arriving via taxi, and were grateful all over again.
"Baudelaire's!" called a familiar voice.
"Baudelaire's!" called another one.
The siblings peered through the dark at the two figures emerging from the taxi, scarcely able to believe their eyes. These people were wearing strange eyeglasses made of two large cones that were attached to their heads with a mass of tangled rope, which was coiled up on top of their heads. Such glasses might have concealed the identity of the people who were wearing them, but the Baudelaires had no trouble recognizing the people who were hurrying toward them, even though they had not seen either person for a very long time, and had thought they would never see them again.
"Justice Strauss!" Violet cried.
"Jerome Squalor!" Klaus cried.
"J.S.!"
Sunny cried.
"I'm so happy to find you," said the judge, taking off her vision-furthering device so she could dab at her eyes and embrace the children one by one. "I was afraid I'd never see you again. I'll never forgive myself for letting that idiotic banker take you away from me."
"And I'll never forgive myself," said Jerome, who had the misfortune of being married to Esme Squalor, "for walking away from you children. I'm afraid I wasn't a very good guardian."
and I'm afraid I wasn't a guardian at all," Justice Strauss said. "As soon as you were taken away in that automobile, I knew I had done the wrong thing, and when I heard the dreadful news about Dr. Montgomery, I began searching for you. Eventually I found other people who were also trying to battle the wicked villains of this world, but I always hoped I would find you myself, if only to say how sorry I was."
"I'm sorry too," Jerome said. "As soon as I heard about all the troubles that befell you in the village of foul devotees, I began my own Baudelaire search. Volunteers were leaving me messages everywhere. At least I thought the messages were addressed to me."
"And I thought they were addressed to me," Justice Strauss said. "There are certainly plenty of people with the initials J.S.
"I began to feel like an imposter," Jerome said.
"You're not imposters," Dewey said. "You're volunteers."
He turned to the Baudelaires.
"Both these people have helped us immeasurably," he said, using a word which here means a whole lot. "Justice Strauss has reported the details of your case to the other judges in the High Court, and Jerome Squalor has done some critical research on injustice."
"I was inspired by my wife," Jerome confessed, removing his vision-furthering device. "Wherever I looked for you, Baudelaires, I found selfish plots to steal your fortune. I read books on injustice in all the libraries you left behind, and eventually wrote a book myself. Odious Lusting After Finance chronicles the history of greedy villains, treacherous girlfriends, bungling bankers, and all the other people responsible for injustice.
No matter what we do, however," Justice Strauss said, "we can't erase the wrongs we did you, Baudelaires."
"She's right," Jerome Squalor said. "We should have been as noble as you are."
"You're noble enough," Violet said, and her siblings nodded in agreement as the judge and the injustice expert embraced them again. When someone has disappointed you, as Justice Strauss and Jerome Squalor disappointed the Baudelaires, it is often difficult to decide whether to continue their acquaintance, even if the disappointers have done noble things in the meantime. There are some who say that you should forgive everyone, even the people who have disappointed you immeasurably. There are others who say you should not forgive anyone, and should stomp off in a huff, no matter how many times they apologize. Of these two philosophies, the second one is, of course, much more fun. But it can also grow exhausting to stomp off in a huff every time someone has disappointed you, as everyone disappoints everyone eventually, and one can't stomp off in a huff every minute of the day. When the Baudelaires thought about the harm that each J.S. had done to them, it was as if they had gotten a bruise quite some time ago, one that had mostly faded, but that still hurt when they touched it, and when they touched this bruise, it made them want to stomp off in a huff. But on that evening, or more properly, very early Wednesday morning, the siblings did not want to stomp off into the hotel, where so many wicked people were gathered, or into the pond, which was likely to be very cold and clammy at this time of night. They wanted to forgive these two adults, and to embrace them, despite their disappointment.
"I don't mean to break up all this embracing," Dewey said, "but we have work to do, volunteers. As one of the first volunteers said a very long time ago, though boys throw stones at frogs in sport, the frogs do not die in sport, but in earnest."
"Speaking of frogs," Justice Strauss said, "I'm afraid to report that we couldn't see a thing from the other side of the pond. These vision-furthering devices work well in the daytime, but looking through special sunglasses after sunset makes everything look as dark as a crow flying through a pitch-black night, which is precisely what we're looking for."
"Justice Strauss is correct," Jerome said sadly. "We couldn't verify the arrival of the crows, or whether their journey was interrupted."
"We couldn't see if even a single crow was trapped," the judge said, "or if the sugar bowl fell into the funnel."
"Funnel?"
Dewey repeated.
"Yes," Justice Strauss said. "You told us that if our enemies shot down the crows, they would have fallen onto the bird paper."
"And if the crows fell onto the bird paper," Jerome continued, "then the sugar bowl
would drop into the laundry room, right?
Dewey looked slyly at the steaming funnel, and then at the surface of the pond.
So it would appear, he said. Our enemies capturing the sugar bowl would be as troubling as their capture of the medusoid mycelium.
So you already know about the plan to shoot down the crows and capture the sugar bowl? Violet said incredulously.
Yes, Dewey said. Justice Strauss learned that the harpoon gun had been taken up to the rooftop sunbathing salon. Jerome noticed that bird paper was dangling out of the window of the sauna in room 613, and I gave Sunny the lock myself so she could lock up the laundry in room 025.
You know about all the villainous people who are lurking in the hotel? Klaus said, equally incredulously.
Yes, Justice Strauss said.
We observed rings on all the wooden furniture from people refusing to use coasters. Obviously, there are many villains staying in the hotel.
Mycelium?
Sunny asked, with perhaps just a touch more incredulousness than her siblings.
Yes, Jerome said. We've learned that Olaf has managed to acquire a few spores locked tight in a diving helmet.
The Baudelaires looked at the commonplace book in Klaus's hands, and then back at the sub-sub-librarian.
"I guess our observations and evidence aren't such valuable contributions after all," Violet said. "All the mysteries we encountered in the hotel had already been solved."
"It doesn't matter, Baudelaires," Jerome said. "Olaf won't dare unleash the medusoid mycelium unless he gets his hands on the sugar bowl, and he'll never find it.
I'm the only one who knows which words will unlock the vernacularly fastened door," Dewey said, ushering the children back toward the entrance of the hotel. "And there's not a villainous person on earth who has done enough reading to guess them before Thursday. By then, all of the volunteers will present the research they've done on Count Olaf and his associates to the prosecution, and all their treachery will finally end."
"Jerome Squalor will be an important witness," Justice Strauss said. "His comprehensive history of injustice will help the High Court reach a verdict."
"Prosecution?" Violet asked. "Witness?" Klaus asked.
"Verdict,"
Sunny said. The three adults smiled at one another, and then at the Baudelaires.
"That's what we've been trying to tell you," Dewey said gently. "VFD has researched an entire catalogue of Olaf's treachery. On Thursday, Justice Strauss and the other judges of the High Court will hear from each and every one of our volunteers. Count Olaf, Esme Squalor, and all of the other villainous people gathered here will finally be brought to justice."
"You'll never have to hide from Olaf again," Jerome said, "or worry that anyone will steal your fortune."
"We just have to wait for tomorrow, Baudelaires," Justice Strauss said, "and your troubles will finally be over."
"It's like my comrade always says," Dewey said. "Right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant."
Wrong!
The clanging of the clock announced that it was 1 in the morning, and without another word, Dewey took Violet's hand, and Justice Strauss took Klaus's, and Jerome Squalor leaned down and took Sunny's hand, and the three adults led the three orphans up the stairs toward the hotel's entrance, walking past the taxi, which still sat there, engine purring, with the figure of the driver just a shadow in the window. The three adults smiled at the children, and the children smiled back. But of course the Baudelaires were not born yesterday, an expression which means young or innocent enough to believe things certain people say about the world. If the Baudelaires had been born yesterday, perhaps they would be innocent enough to believe that all of their troubles were truly about to end, and that Count Olaf and all of his treacherous associates would be judged by the High Court and condemned to the proper punishment for all their ignoble deeds, and that the children would spend the rest of their days working with Dewey Denouement on his enormous underwater catalogue, if they only waited for tomorrow. But the three siblings were not born yesterday. Violet was born more than 15 years before this particular Wednesday, and Klaus was born approximately 2 years after that. And even Sunny, who had just passed out of babyhood, was not born yesterday. Neither were you, unless, of course, I am wrong, in which case, welcome to the world, little baby, and congratulations on learning to read so early in life. But if you were not born yesterday, and you have read anything about the Baudelaire children's lives, then you cannot be surprised that this happy moment was almost immediately cut short by the appearance of a most unwelcome person at the moment the children were led through the fog of steam coming from the laundry room funnel and through the entrance of the Hotel des Noumans as the one loud wrong faded into nothing. This person was standing in the centre of the lobby, his tall, lean body bent into a theatrical pose, as if you were waiting for a crowd to applaud. And you will not be surprised to know what was tattooed on his ankle, which the children could see poking out of a hole in his sock, even in the dim light of the room. You were not born yesterday, probably, so you will not be surprised to find that this notorious villain had reappeared in the Baudelaire's lives for the penultimate time. And the Baudelaires were also not born yesterday, and so they also were not surprised. They were not born yesterday, but when Count Olaf turned to face them and gazed upon them with his shiny, shiny eyes, the Baudelaire orphans wished they had not been born at all.